In case you haven't been here before, this is John Malashok over here. I'm Bruce Adolph over here. And you'll notice, since I'm with a choreographer, dancer, I was careful to sit with him at the same time. But we'll be standing up a little bit and talking, and I realize you may think you're far away and not see as well as usual, and that's because we tried to arrange the room to give a little space to two dancers who will be performing. So ironically, you may not see so well, but at least there's room for them to be invisible in. John, it's a great pleasure to be talking to you already, even we haven't said anything. And
maybe I won't say anything. Dancers don't talk, you know.
Oh, that's not what I've heard. And I think we should start off, though, by before we get into gesture and meaning and music, and since this is a music festival, which has art in it, all this art is related to the music festival and part of it, and now has some dance, which you think would be a normal part of a music festival, but actually it isn't usually, and hardly any festivals of music in the entire United States have dance regularly. We're glad to have you here to start that off.
I'm glad, too. I mean, there's become a spirit of collaboration around this festival, which I'm really excited about. And I'm a very collaboration-oriented artist. And when you think of collaboration around music, I mean, I defy anyone to suggest a collaboration that's more natural than music and dance. I mean, they're both really come out of the same place. And, you know, maybe it's a little one-sided. Music can exist just fine without dance. Dance doesn't usually exist so well without music.
Aha, but you know, obviously there are people who think dance is fine without music. But you're not one of them.
I don't tend to be one of them.
And if you were, this wouldn't be the best place to say that anyway.
No, it wouldn't.
I remember some choreographers saying to me that they love to dance to music, but no more so than to running water.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
Those are the people that gave dance a bad name for a while.
Oh, now we're getting somewhere.
I mean, I'm all for experimentation, and I'm all for sort of pushing limits and boundaries, but there are certain things that are innate and natural within us that have to do with, you know, I mean, certainly going against that, finding music that really takes on a particularly aggressive or abrasive quality to suit a certain emotional expression is just fine. It's a fair game.
You know,
but there's been a lot of choreographers that really approach what they're doing from a very unmusical standpoint. And that
you think purposely?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, and some because musicality isn't part of their orientation.
Now, when I said you think purposely, it feels like you know that's the case. So you do, right? You know that some choreographers are purposely working against music or without it?
I think in the way that modern dance at a certain point was a rebellion against the formality of the ballet world.
Right.
There was a real attitude along with it. There got to be that similar kind of attitude about a conventional use of music.
Mm-hmm.
So it was sort of like going as far to the other end as possible and really approaching things from a not just an unmusical, a non-musical standpoint.
Or amusical.
Amusical.
I just thought there was one missing. But
yeah.
Yeah. That's
I haven't heard that term.
You know, before we get to see two dancers, which we will in a moment, what you're saying reminds me of something that I guess isn't really dance, but what do you think, did you see Wrong, the movie?
Yes.
With Takamitsu's score. We all know the name of the film director.
Kurosawa.
I said that because I couldn't think of it. And you know, I taught at a lot of schools, Juilliard, Yale, NYU, and that's a teaching technique you learn. When you don't know what you can't remember, you say, you know what it is, right? Okay, so thank you, Kurosawa.
I use the Socratic method a lot,
yes,
too.
The Socratic method. That's right. Yes, that puts the tick in Socratic, I'm sure. So the thing that happens in Ron, if you've seen it, you might remember, is there's a huge battle scene, and it's very realistic. You have all of these soldiers, they're like samurai, on horses, charging at each other with swords. It's very bloody, but the camera pulls back, and you're at a tremendous distance from this horrific, aggressive, to say the least, violent scene. But the music by Takamitsu is in slow motion and very peaceful. And what you start to feel is that this took place in history a long time ago, and you feel better and better. It's a horrible thing, but you think this is ancient, and it'll never. You also feel terrible. This is a story that will never end, but at least you're out of it for the moment because of the music. Mm. And I thought that that was an example of, you see, and it wasn't unmusical because at all, but what's interesting there is that the, even though it's not dance, the scene was filmed first, and Takemitsu was allowed to do anything he wanted.
Yeah.
And he went, if you want to put it, anti the image.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's something I want to get into later this evening, is whether you go along with the music or against the music in choreographing. But the Apocalypse Now had a similar sort of
thing.
Right. Some very beautiful use of music against very disturbing scenes.
Would you say that accidentally we're now talking about the fact that that in cinema and in film scores there is also a kind of choreography when there's no dance with scores and action, and that I think we're all very deeply involved in that even if we don't think about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting how it might inform. Do you ever think about, when you see a film, think of it as choreography with the score as...
I don't tend to, but I'm surprised sometimes. We sound like Siskel and Ebert here now talking about films. But I'm surprised sometimes at how hidden the music is sometimes in films. When I'll go back and buy a CD of a soundtrack, I'll listen to something. Was that in the film? Was that in the film? And then I'll go back and watch the film again. Sure enough, it was there.
And I noticed that you did buy one. There's one sitting back there, which we'll get to later.
Yes.
You bought the soundtrack to The Unbearable Lightness of Being.
Yes, and Walter Janacek's music.
Yes, it turns out it's old Janacek, who is a composer, happens to be one of my personally favorite composers.
Mine too.
Yours too. Mm-hmm. Did you know Janacek before the movie?
No, I didn't.
See, now this is an amazing example of a film bringing a composer, at least in America, a composer who is somewhat, I wouldn't say unknown, but severely underappreciated by even people who love music. Suddenly everyone's talking about Janacek, and what tickled me was to see, you have a very sophisticated and eclectic taste there, to see not a Janacek record, but the film score with the Janacek on it, which is quite fascinating. We'll get to that in a moment. But I think we should see some dance.
Okay.
I apologize to those of you who are so far away that you'll only have a vague image of the dance, but it will be brief.
as dance should be.
So tell us what we're going to see and who we're going to see.
Let me introduce something here. I chose this as something to show because it has a very strong Summerfest connection. This last year, I created a very collaborative work. It was a mixture of theater, dance, music, singing, called Blessings and Curses. We premiered it back in May. And had a very eclectic score of music that I brought together. But for me, one of the most important pieces of music that I found was from hearing it at last year's Summerfest. It was Osvaldo Golyov's Dreams and Prayers of Isaac the Blind. I'd never heard the piece of music before, and it just blew me away.
I hope you remember Osvaldo Golyov was here, the other composer in residence, and he was here briefly, but the one piece that most of you probably remember was this, which had a very, very powerful impact. And it is a very Jewish work, especially in sound, not just in the story which it tells, but it is not written for clarinet in the normal sense, or I would say classical sense. It is written for klezmer clarinet. So whoever happens to be playing it has to play that way. And that way alone, even on a single tone, has such a deep connection to very earthy and folksy and not only ethnic but profoundly universal types of things that are defy conventions. And, and it was played very, very beautifully last year by Todd Palmer.
Yeah.
Is that what we're going to hear?
Yeah, I'm going to actually play part of a track from this is the Kronos Quartet with David Krakauer playing. And just so you know, the two dancers who I'll bring out here, come on out, you guys. This is Allie Fisher and Amber Boson, who are members of my company. And this section is, it's a short excerpt, but it is of, the starting point was it was of Sarah being at home waiting, not knowing what's happening to her son Isaac, with her husband having taken him up on the mountain, you know, expecting to kill him. You know, so this was the idea of what is Sarah going through during that time. Again, I'll apologize just slightly because I know visibility is going to be an issue, and there's a few things that they do on the floor that'll be tough to see, but you'll get the feeling here.
Say that you will be able to watch this on television later. we saw?
No, please do.
And this is one of the things that really interests me personally about dance. And I should tell the audience that I'm not a complete outsider to the dance world. My father briefly danced with Jose Limon, very briefly. I think it was one season, but he did do that. It wasn't his profession. He was a guy who was on the radio as an actor, briefly, wrote a few articles and books, and gave that up and actually danced well enough to dance with Limon briefly. So I grew up...
My father took a couple of tap dance classes, but I can't...
didn't dance with Limon?
No.
Well, that's probably why you did what you did. But my question, one of the things I saw right away that I found very communicative and very powerful, but I also wanted to know whether you were thinking of them the way I was looking at them, was I thought of a few things, and you could react to them. I felt that there was an element of possession, that the dancers were being manipulated by a force outside themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And another was that you had some symbols of that. So, for example, I mean, at one point their hands were being grasped and pulled,
yes,
as if someone else was pulling them, and they were trying to keep away. And there was also some stuff where the feeling was that they had been taken over not in a corny way at all, but in the way that is within a superstitious sense of religion that happens to people, a kind of very basic possession.
Yeah.
And my question then is, if this is at all true, A, and secondly, did you use a vocabulary that specifically was related to possession?
Well, I mean, this is a great question, because this is, in a way, one of dance's most difficult issues. And it's whether people feel like something so specific is being communicated,
right,
that they can't understand it. And I don't see dance as being like talking about astrophysics.
No.
You know, where it's a language that's very particular and hard to understand.
Right.
But it does look that way. I mean, you know, you look at a gesture like this one at the end, you know, and yeah, I have the idea of kind of pulling shades open and looking and closing. And that'll occur to some people, and other people, you know, it'll look like something else.
But what about
yes,
you?
Yes, with something like this.
Yeah.
I have my own, you know, little thoughts, and I actually try not to get too specific. Something like this, yes, it is like a force outside yourself getting, you know, pulling you around. So it's like being possessed. But I don't take the kind of approach to say,
right,
you know, somebody else is going to see it a different way.
Yes, but my question is, though, to what extent in creating this is there a conscious use of gestures that have meanings outside of abstract dance? I don't mean percentage-wise.
Yeah.
In other words, even just that one motion, did you just do that and then you think later that that's what that is,
or
did you look?
Times, yes. That's a lot of times,
because
what
you're
happens,
thinking in dance.
That in, yeah, you realize what you're doing after the fact,
mm-hmm,
rather than beforehand.
Right.
And I'm sure you go through this,
yes,
in writing music. You've got to go to a certain place where you're responding intuitively to things rather than, you know, deciding I'm going to tell a story about this.
Yes, although I have a slightly different theory about that, which I don't think is different from what you said, except in a profound semantic way,
mm-hmm,
but not essentially. Which is, see, a lot of you have been to these things, as you've heard a lot of discussions over the years, last 2 years, about after the fact, exactly what John just said. You realize what it is after the fact, or as Joan Tower was saying, you title it after the fact. My feeling about that is that you do know while you're doing it, but not in words.
Mm-hmm.
You know in dance. And when you mean you realize it after the fact is that you find a word or two for it and it becomes English. Does that make sense to you?
It does make sense. And this sort of goes to something that I actually wanted to say at the beginning, which
uh-huh,
I don't profess to, you know, I'm not going to talk about many other choreographers' approaches. You know, I'm going to
feel free to.
I will. I will. But I'm just saying, it's, you know, the approaches are so individual, just like composers' approaches are,
right,
so individual, that I can't make any kind of blanket statements. It's going to be easier if I say,
no, but you
this
should,
is more how
let's
I
assume that you're
things,
talking about yourself at all times, unless you use the name Mark Morris or Paul Taylor.
Right,
or
right.
Okay. So so you like that idea that you're thinking in dance, so after the fact you might think window or shade, and then it seems trivialized for you when you do that, right? Or no? Not that it looks that way, but that...
No, I actually like images that that say something.
Uh-huh.
But like I said, I don't tend to plan them out. This is what I consider one of my strengths in choreography, is sort of an intuitive response to music. You know, I'm good with music, but I'm not particularly trained in music.
And you're talking about that as an advantage.
I am, because I hear it in a way that doesn't throw me into thinking about it. It lets me go right into responding to it.
Now, when I think of choreographers, and you did not say this, but I can think of choreographers who read music and most don't. I would say hardly any do. The only two I could think of that I know from just reading and talking are Balanchine and who's dead, of course, and Mark Morris. Do you think there are lots of them who don't? Most people don't read music.
Oh, I think it varies a lot. I mean, Mark Morris is a good example of someone who's a little bit at the other end of the scale from me. I really approach things, like I said, intuitively and emotionally in terms of response to music. Mark approaches his movement very much like a musician and incredibly literally. That's sort of his trademark in a way, is it's like physicalizing the score of music on the page. You know, the notes go up and down and his movement goes up and down, and it's almost a movement per note. It sometimes can get that literal, which is fun to watch. But I really like being able to sort of go one way or the other, stray from that, go opposite to what the music is doing, and pick up the emotion of it rather than the structure.
Now, what would you like to, musically speaking, I know you brought quite a bit of music with you. Do you want to go into that, or would you rather show a video next? Because we have all this equipment, we have to use it.
That's right. Oh, and there's that piano.
You got your dancers, you have your piano, you've got your video.
Let me show a video. It's another section from Blessings and Curses. And let me just go ahead and show this, and
sure.
I'll explain a little bit of the approach on this. Let's hope this works.
This is a color wheel. This is thread. This is your mind. Together, they make whatever you choose.
I remember my father's voice behind me in shul. He would chant in Hebrew while I prayed silently. He would bless God, and I would ask, please, keep my dad's voice in my ear. He thought he was teaching me to weave, to read, to pray. But I only learned to yearn for my father at my back. And to weave. I did learn to weave.
If I think so. This is my wife, Nina. It was a pleasure to perform with her on this. This actually is the Latvian Women's Choir. The composer on that is Selga Mense or something like that. I'd have to look on the disc to remember the spelling. It's beautiful, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. Now this, I picked this for a couple of reasons, aside from the fact that I like this duet.
Yeah.
But it also, it has a meter to it, that music. But I definitely ignored that.
Mm-hmm.
I let the flow of the music and the emotion of it tell me what to do movement-wise, and then worried later about beginning to tie it to certain key points.
Yeah.
In there, so that it has an organic flow to it, and yet it's not ignoring the music. It just it fits to it after the fact.
Do you ever work having listened to a piece of music without it, in silence, just remembering it and then putting it back together, or not? In other words, you always, or do you listen
not
really
very
phrase
often.
By phrase?
You know, the music is so often the. I tell people this, that a lot of times, I usually work from a theme. I have an idea. My biggest challenge then is to find what music I want to use to express that. Once I have the music, I'm 90% of the way there. Coming up with the movement for me is the easy part.
Mm-hmm. Well, how many different pieces of music were in this Blesses and Curses?
13.
13 pieces of music, and how? 13 distinct, totally separate pieces.
Yes.
Right. And they were all different composers and performers? So
yes.
It's a very eclectic.
I mean, I think four or five were actually the same group called Davka from San Francisco.
But it was 13 composers?
The Davka ones, they're a group. I'm not sure whether they, they're all composed by one person or not. But it's very diverse music. Yeah.
And so that's a good example, though, of you're having something in mind and looking for. I know what that feels like when, let's say, I want to tell a story or have a certain image in music, and I feel the music, and I'm looking, as Joan Tower and I were discussing, about titles.
Mm.
And then sometimes you find the title, and you convince yourself at some point, after several lectures and interviews, that in fact was what got you inspired to begin with. And then you realize that's not the case. It was purely musical. And that after writing program notes and people asking about the title, you forget that the title was an afterthought.
And you realize you don't know where the hell the piece came from. I mean, it's, yeah.
That's right.
Yes,
Very briefly, I have a piece called Turning Returning, which was just purely music for me. And then I came up with the idea of calling it Turning Returning because the images of the music kept spinning like dancers. And then someone suggested to me that it was like turning and returning in bed, someone in the audience, turning around when you can't sleep.
Mm.
And eventually I included that thought in my discussion of the piece. And it wasn't until after it was in print that way, even in program notes, that the fitful spinning around in bed and that kind of feeling was the inspiration for the piece that I realized that came from an audience member after it had been composed.
Yeah. Yes, right. Right.
It's still valid, though.
Going. though slightly cheapened.
Yes. Only because now I have to tell the whole story.
Yeah.
Afterwards.
Yeah. Yes.
It's still valid because we keep things because they're right.
You brought up a question, though, about whether I always work with the music right there in front of me. Well, I don't always have the luxury, and some of my most difficult experiences have been cases where I commissioned a score of music, and because of the timeline of that, I don't start receiving drafts or, even these sort of little plinked out versions on a bad audio tape to work from until very late in the game. So I may have a theme, I have an idea, I've done movement exploration to begin, sort of the framework for this thing, and then this music starts dribbling in that maybe doesn't even fit what I was originally thinking or expecting, and it means sort of veering off a whole nother direction. But so it's hard because I really do use the music as the inspiration for the movement. So if I get something that's, lesser in quality at that point, it's hard to find a way to really blend it all
together. Or that doesn't match your movement exploration. the way you expect it. Now, that's always difficult. You know, I've heard people say after hearing a new piece, that wasn't what I expected. I can't imagine what they mean. But here you are doing the same thing, because you're expecting the composer to write something, and you get something else. But the most interesting thing you said, if I were just listening, which I was, would be the expression movement exploration. Could you tell everybody what that is and how that works?
Well, sometimes before I ever start what I call choreographing, really setting movement down that I'm going to hold on to, sometimes we'll spend weeks and weeks of doing improvisation on certain ideas. Just so I'll let the dancers have input in terms of how they move, and I'll see different approaches to a subject. And then I'll start pulling out little ideas. Oh, I like that, and I begin building on that, or hold on to what you did in that improvisation, and let it start growing that way.
Mm-hmm. So in that sense, the dancers, who your dancers are, matters a great deal.
It matters a great deal. It really does. So the cohesiveness of the group that I'm working with at the time has a huge impact on the dance.
Have you seen any of those computer programs where choreographers move animated dancers around? The dancers can do anything at all?
Sure.
Not that I need to ask, but what do you think of those?
They're fun toys. I've dabbled a little bit.
Has anything ever come out of it for you?
Only what you're saying in terms of making a supposed body do something that it can't do. My dancers,
which is a great pleasure, we all know that.
My dancers oftentimes joke with me about, you know, they can see it coming when I'm about to ask them to do something that's not physically possible. And I say, oh, you've been reading comic books again, haven't you? And you know, so I mean, I have these things. All of a sudden you're working with people, well, God, what if, you know, what if the person like was here and sprung up and, you know, I caught over, you know, it's just, you know, the images just come out. You know, well, I suppose you put notes together that are pretty tough to play.
Yes, but, that does happen. And you find some players, you know, for example, the famous story of the Barber Violin Concerto, when it was first given to the violinist who was going to play it, not only did he not play it, but he said it was unplayable. Mm. And now, of course, it's played a lot by many, many people. Mm-hmm. And so in that particular case, the violinist was wrong because for somehow or other, it was too hard for him to commit to the energy and the practicing to learn it.
Yeah. Now, yes? I'm going to respond to what you asked, though, about movement exploration. One of the pieces I did about 5 years ago called Tribes, we spent a tremendous amount of time in movement exploration. I really had an idea, I had a concept of the dancers inventing fantasy cultures. I mean, really, you know, we did writing things, I wanted people to invent cultures that had nothing necessarily to do with reality. I mean, some of the cultures they invented were, you know, lived in outer space, others lived on deserted islands. You know, I asked them to make up everything in terms of what they eat, how they interact, what social customs they have, how they procreate, everything. And then we came back and we came up with movement that represented them. All the while, I'm waiting for the music to come. It was Yale Strum who was composing the music. And we had talked about the piece and sort of a structure and this and that. Well, the music started coming in and it was nothing like we had talked about.
Definitely from planet Earth.
Yeah, and very jazzy.
Oh, very jazzy.
Very jazzy.
So it was a very distinct location in your head, too.
Yeah.
You know, there is a piece of music based on cultures that don't exist by Steve Mackey.
Oh, well, we'll have to talk about that.
We should talk about it. Yeah, we'll take a look at it.
Anyway, it made for this, you know, and the tapes that he was sending me. I mean, it was like, it wasn't even playing the stuff. It was sort of like a few scratchy notes and saying, hey, and then, John, we're going to have 8 bars of the bass coming in here. And, you know, so just imagine that. And then he'd go on to something else. I mean, it was just, and then as we got closer, I started hearing what the music really was.
Well, you know,
it turned out, you know, because I did have to end up conforming to, you can't ignore the music, and it was very insistent music.
Well, that's
music.
A very interesting problem. I mean, I could think of people who, if the music really didn't work, now you probably don't have this luxury economically, but would chuck the score.
Well, you hear all sorts of stories in the dance world where people, you know, they're having to work from something as a substitute until they have the real thing. Well, when it comes right down to it, I mean, choreographers get very attached to what the way they're working and what they're working with. you'll hear this all the time, that they'll get to that point and say, I don't want it played live. I want to use what you sent me.
What sort you of sent me, yes, yeah. Right, that's right. Because it's exactly, it's...
Yeah, and it's what they've choreographed.
That's right, and the music can be played and will never quite be the same.
Yeah.
Do you know, for example, that these Chihuly sculptures are never the same? That these pieces are disassembled and put back by his staff in the way that they can and knowing what he wants, but they're never exactly the same.
Mm.
Isn't that extraordinary? I just learned that from David Finkel, who was just talking to Dale Chihuly. And I find that, in terms of dance and performance, to be extraordinary. Because here we look at this and we say, oh, I know that piece.
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking about a piece of music where every time it's live, it's to a certain extent different. We all, musicians know that.
Yes.
This afternoon, I was rehearsing my clarinet quintet from 1992 with David Schiffer and Fred Sherry, Toby Hoffman, Chi Yun, and Ani Kavafian. And three of them recorded it. Two of them had never seen it till this summer. And we all know the recording, but it's a lot like it and still different. And mm-hmm. nothing's changed that you can put your finger on. And, you know, with dance, it seems to me, you have that as soon as you change one dancer, the whole piece is entirely different, even if they do the same moves.
Right. And when you add live music to dance,
yes.
I mean, it's the... I mean, it's a true pleasure to work with live music, and it's also, you know, got that risk quality to it.
There was one risk time, is what we love about live performance.
Yeah, there was one time when I was with, I used to dance with Twyla Tharp's company in New York, and there was a piece that Dick Hyman used to play for us now and then called Baker's Dozen. It was mm-hmm. to Willie the Lion Smith's music. And it had this wonderful intro before the curtain would ever come up. And he'd play this thing, and it would sort of, boom, end. The curtain would rise, and we'd start dancing. Well, a couple of things would happen. First of all, technical things always go wrong. But one night, you know, so we'd always be backstage sort of dancing and warming up and getting ready while he's playing the thing, knowing that the curtain wouldn't come up. Well, of course, one night, you know, we're out there all on stage. The curtain goes up right in the middle of this intro that he's playing. And it was like, you know, in a New York apartment when you turn the lights on, the roaches all head for the corners.
I can see you really did live in New York, yeah.
I did. It was like that. There was also time, because, you know...
It's like in La Jolla when you walk in and the alarms go off.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, go ahead.
But Dick, you know, for being the wonderful musician right. that he is, he was also, you know, sort of looking at things from music first. And I remember this one section where, you know, sort of came to a sort of a slow, sustained thing, and then it would start into another section. And we all had this very timed out to sort of come around and ready. And we did this one time here, and boom, he just launched into this thing. And, I mean, so fast that, you know, it was amazing that we were able to kind of somehow get back together. But it's exciting. It's fun. It's fun.
And I bet people watched that. And, of course, being audience members assumed that that's correct. And came up with a scenario that, what a wonderful, it's probably reviewed too, the Twyla Tharp's idea of catching the dancers before the tempo change and
yeah,
having
right.
to scramble, how she combines the art of confusion with and the brilliance of being caught in the emotional yeah. act, and as dancers, that you could find the expression to be lost and found at the same time. Okay, and look, when push comes to shove, she's very good. Anyway. Okay. So speaking of
what was your name, Anna Kissel-Goff?
Yeah, please. Speaking of movement exploration, you've got dancers there.
Yeah.
Can we make them do something?
Sure. Why not?
I have to tell you, you know, you don't do this to musicians too often, but with dancers, they do it to them all the time. Just, they're there, use them.
That's right. It's all about finding more ways to be cruel to your dancers. Come on out, you guys. So, I was talking with Bruce a little bit about the notion that dancers only have one opportunity to react to music for the first time. They only get one first impression. And that's a very key thing to be aware of when when I'm beginning some of that movement exploration, is to really watch what happens at the instant that they hear something. Because after that, there's going to be a certain thought process. There's going to be other filters that they're taking the movement through.
So is this Malashok or Rorschach, this idea? No, go ahead.
Yeah. So I want to set up something here where I'll give just the loosest of contexts here. So because actually this fall I'm going to be working on a project based on relationships. So it might as well be Rorschach. And so I thought, okay, we'll start out. Two sisters. We know sisterhood is a complex relationship, full of all sorts of different variations and possibilities. So I'm just going to give them that as a role. I'm not going to give them anything more except music that none of us have ever heard before.
Including me.
Including Bruce.
So I'm going to do some improvisation, trying to give them something to respond to immediately. So the only thing I can say for sure, since I don't know what I'm doing yet, is that I'm very glad that you're all so nice and we're relaxed here, because improvisation is a very strange thing to do in front of people. For musicians, I improvise a lot at home, but it's different at home. So just pretend this is my living room, and as far as you're concerned, you improvise in front of a choreographer all the time, right? So do you do a lot of improvisation in front of audiences?
Not recently.
Yeah, it's a rather unusual thing to do.
Yeah, it
is. So let's do that. Now, by improvisation, I should also stress that this isn't like jazz. Jazz improvisation is based on chord formulas and patterns that everyone agrees upon, often on a song that pre-exists. This is what's called absolutely pure improvisation. Could be anything, have no idea what's going to happen, and all you know is your sisters, which you're not really, right? Do either of you have a sister?
No.
Neither of you have a sister. That should make it easy. We're going to try another one. I found most of the time I was thinking about the fact that my sleeves are covering over my fingers here. So I'm going to take John's suggestion and roll my sleeves up. It made it hard to play certain things, but okay. That was quite wonderful to watch what I could see of it.
Now, do you want to keep the same relationship?
You mean sisters? How about something that they know from personal experience?
Do we want any suggestions about relationships?
Somebody said dancers. I thought that was hysterical. Yeah. Any suggestions? Let's do it like that. That's a good mother and daughter.
Mother and daughter.
Okay. I like mother and daughter. That's everyone knows that one, especially you two. Not everyone. I mean, you know, all females know that. Thank you. So, John, the question now is, let's say they did that. Would you actually normally in movement exploration allow them to do so much and then you edit or take or reject, or is that too much?
Well, what I saw right from the beginning was an idea that was would have been plenty for me to build on.
Right. A motif.
The idea, yeah, a motif. The idea of the different speeds that a mother and a daughter move at.
Yes.
You know, it started out, there was kind of a quick move that you think of as more childlike and, you know, and a more sustained kind of thing. That's plenty to work with. I mean,
yes.
I could build 5 minutes.
You could turn that around too later.
Sure.
When the mother's on Prozac.
You're right.
And the daughter says, I have to treat her like she's my own.
All right. You know, or there were other things in there. There was a point where there was something like this, but she ducked down. Yeah.
Okay. Right, no, that's right.
But that sort of, you know, avoiding the other one, not wanting to be controlled.
Right.
So there were plenty of motifs that I saw in there that I could work from.
Would you find that a dancer, after you've used a particular person for movement exploration, comes up with the same things enough for you to want not to use that person anymore? They become cliched for
like,
you or too familiar?
The way they approach things?
The way they approach improvisation.
Well, you know, not really. That becomes part of my job, uh-huh. to how to structure the improvisation. I get tired of my own approaches sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, and I really have to push myself to, you know, find a different way to begin in on something. You know, or it doesn't feel like I'm repeating a beginning point.
Did you ever do the kind of choreography that I know, for example, Martha Clark uses, which is to allow large groups of people to do that and then to choreograph their relationship to each other, but not what they're doing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. That's one of those personal approaches.
You don't like that.
That's just,
right.
It's just not my approach.
Yeah, right.
But you know, it's fascinating what she does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Now, is there another piece of music that you want to talk about, or shall we?
I wanted to talk a little bit about the idea of the choice between going with what the music suggests. And this is where I'm saying intuitively,
yes.
I mean, I can listen, someone can hand me a CD, you know, that has 12 tracks, and I can go through and, you know, I can listen for 5 to 10 seconds and know whether there's anything of interest in that track to me, movement-wise or choreographically.
Or at least
and then
to,
I just
in
go
that
on
amount
to
of
the
music,
next
yeah.
one. Yeah. And then... you know, and then some of them, I just, I hear movement in them.
Mm-hmm.
But certain music, particularly in the classical world, I mean, it really suggests something. It's either, you know, like those beautiful middle sections of classical works where they're, you know, long and sustained.
The slow movements.
They're so beautiful that they suggest a certain something. Or the fast ones really have a very insistent rhythm that you could hardly get away from.
Mm-hmm.
I don't always like the idea of, like I said earlier, just physicalizing what the music suggests. I feel like in a collaboration, unless each artist brings something different to the collaboration, well, why bring them together?
Right. Do you ever think, when you're talking about intuitive and emotional reaction to music, I've seen what I thought was a musical form put on stage, but I don't think that it was a conscious reference to that musical form. I'm going to describe it to you briefly. It was a Merce Cunningham piece.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll go back and say what the musical form is first. There's a very well-known and beloved form in music, which has been sort of dead for many, many years, which is the chorale cantata. The chorale cantata is primarily the domain of Bach. He invented it, he developed it, he wrote a great many of them. And then after that, occasionally people would use it, and it fell out of favor even before the classical period, really. And it's a Baroque phenomenon. And it's only appeared now and then in pieces of music that have a sense of nostalgia for the Baroque. And what happens in that kind of piece is that you have a theme that might be a Lutheran hymn, what we call a cantus firmus, which is a fixed song, moving by very, very slowly and then lots of music chugging away underneath it. Mm-hmm. So that you know, the trumpets and the sopranos come in with Ein feste Burg or one of the great hymns, and the strings and the chorus are going, you know, all over the place like this. And Handel imitates that quality in the Messiah a little bit, but never follows it straight through. And I was thinking what a beautiful form it is to have these two tempi, one of which represents the spiritual world, which is the trumpets and the sopranos usually, although it could be somewhere else. And then the movement that is much faster in 16th notes that is going by represents instead the busy life, the daily life of the average human being who will die and eventually go to heaven. And you can see paintings like this, not here right now, but paintings in which you have the heavens portrayed literally with angels looking down with trumpets. And then below that, lots of crazy activity going on in battle scenes and the entire story of the Bible, things like that, while there's slow motion on top. And I went to see a Merce Cunningham performance in which his dancers were flying all over the stage wildly, constantly. But he, this was only a few years ago, he was 80-something years old, he walked across the stage on a diagonal in very, very slow motion. It took him almost 10 minutes to just walk across the stage.
Yeah.
And the dancers were flying all over the place. And I think I certainly, whether the whole audience or not, I don't know, I certainly was riveted on him.
Uh-huh.
And to me, it was that form of music where the spiritual, eternal thing was represented by this slow movement of in this case, a rather old dancer. But it was quite beautiful. It had a Zen quality, too. And the fast dancers, as amazing and technically superb as they were trivia.
Well, they become a counterpoint to the main action. And I'm thinking of the scene, put it in more bass terms here, the scene in West Side Story where Tony and Maria see each other for the first time in the middle of this dance, everyone's doing the thing, and and they see each other, and they got the spotlights on them, and they're walking toward each other while all the other stuff is going on. You're not looking at all those other dancers at that point. You're looking at Tony and Maria.
That's right. Which, of course, comes from West Side Story, where that's supposed, from Romeo and Juliet, where that supposedly happens, too.
Yeah. That's a well-used tool in dance, actually, to even taking the same movement, a movement phrase, and putting it in double time, having some do it in double time and others doing it in a very sort of slow
Well, we
thing.
Do that in music, too.
Sure.
Yeah, to have different speeds of things going on at the same time. In fact, that is what happens in Turning Returning over and over.
I'm going to show an example of what I'm talking about.
I'll just go away.
No, don't go away. I'm going to play a piece of music that you're actually all, I'm sure, very familiar with. How's that? Is that for an intimidating comment? Okay, now this is something, a piece that I did to Villa-Lobos music quite a few years ago. And this section is the Bachianus Brasileiras number 6. It's the vocal thing, that beautiful piece of music. I wanted to approach it in a way where I didn't want to disrespect the music, but again, I didn't want to just physicalize it. I worked to find a character that responded to this music, and it turned out to be kind of a quirky character. But in the same way that with any good comedy, you've got to approach it very seriously for it to be effective. There has to be a tremendous commitment to the way you approach something. So I'll just do a little tiny piece of this. Probably should take my shoes off, but oh well. Let's see if this is. I'd have to play with that volume. But leave it. Thank you. emotional, melodramatic kind of feel. But it really takes its inspiration from the music in a way that it...
And you get the feeling that the music is happening over there, and you stumbled upon it,
yeah.
And you're like a harlequin or somebody who
right.
just doesn't know what to make
yeah.
of this.
You know, or yeah. somebody out in the street looking up at, you know, the beautiful woman in the window.
Do you keep that up for the entire movement?
I do a solo through that main first 2 minutes, and then yeah. it goes into a group section.
Yes. It seemed like something was going to happen, something would have to happen to this guy.
Yeah. yeah.
Or some other people would have yes. to come along.
Yeah, yeah. definitely. So anyway, it's really a fun choice of when.
Is he transformed at the end? Or does he leave having learned nothing? Or
Well, the situation is very different by the end. Yeah. yeah.
I'm very curious. What I like about that is I have all these questions about this guy now, which is what it should be like when a piece of music starts. You, without thinking of it, you hopefully wonder what's going to happen next or where is this going in a good way, not mm-hmm. where is this going, and. But what you did is I felt like I was at chapter one, mm. and then, of course, Katya starts crying or something, and you can't finish the end of the chapter. But that's very nice, very good beginning.
Thanks.
Thank you, John, for a wonderful exploration. Okay.